good at reading people. Not that good, though. Valerie knew exactly where to find the ladies' room. She simply wanted to make sure the Saudi knew where he was going. After stacking her chips, she stood up from the table and walked away, not once looking back at Aldessari to make sure he was watching. Hell, that would have been redundant. Right on cue, he was waiting for Valerie when she stepped out of the ladies' room a couple of minutes later. He was pretending to be finishing a call on his cell. She was pretending to be surprised to see him. "Well played," he said. "The right card fell for me, that's all," she answered. "But thank you." He took a step toward her, extending his hand. "My name's Shahid, by the way." Valerie extended her hand in return, smiling when he held on to it for a split second longer after she let go. "I'm Beverly." His black suit was clearly custom-made. The white shirt was silk, and the open collar showcased a gold chain that was gaudy, but not quite rap star-esque. "Some men will never learn that outside of a wedding band, jewelry is best left to the women."
"Where are you from, Beverly? I'm assuming not from here."
"Back east," she said. "DC."
"I know the town well. I actually do a little business there."
More than a little, Valerie was thinking. None of it legal, either. This charade, the entire operation, was all about proving it. "And what about here?" she asked. "Is Vegas business, too?"
"Sometimes it is, yes," he said. "This particular trip, though, is simply for pleasure."
"I hope I didn't just ruin it for you." He smiled.
"That depends."
"On what?"
"On whether or not I can buy you a drink."
"If I'm not mistaken, we're in a casino, Shahid," she said. "The drinks are free."
His smile widened. "In that case, I'll buy you two."
Valerie inched closer to him. It was subtle but unmistakable. "You're quite the charmer, aren't you?"
"Is that bad?"
he asked, playing along. "It may not be good."
"According to Oscar Wilde, it doesn't matter," said Aldessari, flashing his Ivy League education. "It is absurd to divide people into good or bad. People are either charming or tedious."
Valerie tried to bite her tongue. The trickiest part of any undercover operation was forgetting who you were in light of who you were supposed to be. She knew the quote. She even knew the Oscar Wilde play it came from, Lady Windermere's Fan. But between her and Beverly Sands, only one of them had been a drama major at Northwestern. Still, she couldn't help herself. Besides, the goal was to beguile Aldessari, wasn't it? Valerie took another step toward him, this one far less subtle. They were close now, very close. Had it been a Catholic school dance, the nuns would have surely separated them. "We're all in the gutter," she whispered. "But some of us are looking at the stars." Immediately, Aldessari took a step back. He was genuinely surprised.
"You're familiar with the play?"
Considering she'd just quoted another line from it, it was a rhetorical question. But Valerie wasn't about to point that out. Neither was Beverly Sands. "The girl can do more than just play poker," she quipped. He stepped toward her again, his crocodile loafers barely touching the ground.
"I'd like to learn more about you, Beverly."
Valerie smiled, the kind of smile that suggested the feeling was mutual. She'd practiced it many times in front of a mirror. "I want to learn more about you too, Shahid. And I intend to. Far more than you could ever imagine. Far more than you ever thought possible." Chapter 62. It was more like a pit in the brain as opposed to the stomach. "I'm going to miss Claire's funeral." The thought had been lodged in the back of my head, if only because the rest of me was still grappling with the fact that there was going to be a funeral in the first place. Maybe, just maybe, I'd thought, the fact that I couldn't be there, or even for the time being explain why to her sister, would get easier to bear as the days pressed on. Instead, it was only getting more difficult, especially after Owen and I left the city. Every man has his price. For the driver of the livery cab who took Owen and me all the way from Manhattan to Washington, D.C., it was $900. The guy made a big stink about having to get it all in cash. Little did he know that was the only way we could pay him. Our credit cards, each and every one, had been canceled before we even crossed the George Washington Bridge into Jersey. A few attempts at some online purchases in an open Wi-Fi hotspot were all it took to find out. Presumably,
Our ATM cards were shut down, too. So that was the game now. They, whoever they were, knew there was no point trying to find us courtesy of Amex, Visa, or MasterCard, or any bank withdrawal. That left the flip side, cutting off our funding and hoping it would limit our options travel-wise. It's always harder to hit a moving target. All the more reason why Owen and I were on the move. Our first stop after the 5.5-hour drive was the part of D.C. you never see in the brochure. It was a used car dealership on the Anacostia side of the city in the southeast quadrant. The owner, who looked like a walking mugshot, didn't have a showroom. He didn't even have an office. It was basically a dirt lot behind an abandoned warehouse with about a dozen beat-up cars, half of which had had their VIN numbers altered or filed away altogether. "How the hell did you know about this place?" I asked Owen. "I overheard some Georgetown frat boys talking about it in Adin and DeLuca," he said. "Apparently, driving Daddy's Mercedes around campus has fallen out of vogue. Junk is the new black." In that case, Owen and I were now the trendiest guys around. We drove away in an old Toyota Corolla that was dinged up so much you would have thought it had been parked out in the middle of a golf driving range. But it ran okay and came with plates, our two requirements. As for the paperwork, that consisted only of the money that changed hands. $700 cash. Needless to say, we didn't ask to see the Carfax.
"What a steal," said Owen.
"Yeah, that's because it probably was," I said. "Stolen." From Anacostia, we drove into Georgetown, heading straight to Biltmore Street and the townhouse of Dr. Douglas Whitmer. Last seen, on camera at least, deep inside the CIA black site at Stare Kikute outside Warsaw. "That was one hell of a house call, Doc. Care to tell us who hired you? Yes? No?" According to Google, Whitmer had been a thoracic surgeon at Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan for 11 years, followed by a 4-year stint at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Then he apparently quit the operating room, joining a medical research company, BioNext Laboratories in Bethesda, Maryland, as its CEO. That was 5 years ago. The website for BioNext looked legit, although that wasn't really saying much. A 10th grader these days can build a believable website in less time than it takes to watch a rerun of The Simpsons. So too can the CIA.
"Do you think it's a front?" I asked Owen.
"It doesn't have to be," he said. "The guy might simply be pulling double duty. It's more common than you'd think among certain doctors, whether it be for the FBI or the CIA. For a few moments, I thought about my primary care physician back in New York, who once dropped my urine sample all over his suede shoes. Great guy and a good doctor, but somehow I just couldn't picture him doing a secret gig for the government." Dr. Douglas Whitmer was a different story, and as Owen and I walked up the steps of his faded brick townhouse, we couldn't wait to hear it. But that was exactly what we had to do. Wait. We rang the bell, knocked on the door, and even peeked through the windows. No one was home. Whitmer's phone number was unlisted, and for all we knew, he could have been back in Poland, or at any one of a number of other black sites. Seeing the day's mail waiting for him in his mailbox, however, gave us some hope. Now all we could do was park our shiny new Corolla a little way down the street and keep watch. If only we'd known. We were being watched as well.
Chapter 63.
"Go ahead and ask," said Owen.
"Ask what?"
He looked at me across the front seat like I was an idiot for trying to play dumb. "You want to know why I keep doing this thing with my hands, right?" We'd been waiting for Whitmer for close to an hour, and half the time the kid was doing his dry wash routine.
"Sort of hard not to notice," I said.
"You can blame my Aunt Eleanor." He rested both palms on his knees and explained. "My parents, both professors, weren't terribly religious, but they thought it was important for me at a young age to experience church. So my Aunt Eleanor was enlisted one Sunday to bring me to a service. I was 5 and doing complex algebra, but I also still believed in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. So the minister is giving this sermon about temptation and sin, and he's all fired up, and I'm sitting there in the pew listening and hanging on his every word. And that's when he quotes an old proverb, only I don't know it's a proverb, I take it literally. Idle hands are the devil's workshop."
"You're kidding me."
"Nope. That's how it started," he said. "Problem is,
I haven't been able to stop ever since. He laughed. You know, I've never told anyone that before.
Trust me, I said. You've got far bigger secrets these days.
As if on cue, a black Jaguar XK coupe pulled into the short driveway at the base of Whitmer's townhouse. It had to be him. The wait was over. Quickly, Owen and I stepped out of our slightly less expensive Corolla and approached him as he was getting his mail. By the time he looked up and saw us, we were practically in his face. No exaggeration, he must have jumped back at least 3 feet. We'd scared the shit out of him.
Good.
Next up, with any luck, was getting the truth out of him. Dr. Whitmer? I asked. He was still catching his breath.
Who the hell wants to know? Said his look.
But no normal person outside the Bronx actually says that in real life. And Douglas Whitmer appeared as normal as they come. With his glasses and neatly trimmed dark hair that was gray around the temples, he was a doctor who looked like the stock photo of a doctor.
Yes, that's me, he said finally.
I introduced myself and was about to introduce Owen when I saw Whitmer's eyes beat me to it with a squint of recognition. His jaw then literally dropped.
Jesus, you're the kid, aren't you? He asked.
Alive and in the flesh, said Owen. Of course, you probably thought I'd be dead by now. Whitmer nodded almost sheepishly.
Rest assured, it hasn't been for lack of trying.
Owen turned to me in my beat-up face, the bruises just beginning to settle into a nice shade of eggplant. And that's to put it mildly.
Wait, what's going on? I asked. How does he know who you are?
To say the kid was quick on the uptake didn't do him justice.
Because he's been shown a picture of me, said Owen. And if I were ever to pay him a visit, he was supposed to let them know.
I wouldn't, though, said Whitmer.
I mean, I won't.
Of course you won't, said Owen facetiously. What possible motivation could you have? Now I was all caught up. If these weren't their exact words, they had to be damn close. Help us find the kid before he brings us all down, Dr. Whitmer, including you.
I don't care that I'm in the recordings, said Whitmer. It was a mistake, and I can live with the consequences.
Actually, I don't care that you're in the recordings either, said Owen. All I care about is who put you there. That's what we need to know.
Whitmer's eyes shifted between Owen and me for a few moments. The latest issue of Car and Driver and the rest of his mail pressed hard against his chest.
It was one thing for him not to rat us out. It was another for him to rat out whomever he was working for. There would need to be a reason. A damn good one.
Whitmer looked up at the sky.
We all did. The sun was beginning to set behind a mass of charcoal-colored clouds that seemed to have arrived out of nowhere, much like Owen and me.
I think we should go inside, said the doctor. It looks like rain.
Chapter 64.
It was a home for a guy who basically wasn't home all that much. That or he just didn't care. Not to say it was messy. Rather, it was sparse. In the few rooms we walked past before settling in the kitchen, the furnishings consisted of the bare minimum, or in the case of the empty dining room, even less. I wasn't much for metaphors, but Claire always was. For her, this would have been a layup. Dr. Douglas Whitmer clearly had money, but to see where he lived, how he lived, was to see a man defined by what he didn't have. There were things missing in his life.
You want coffee?
He asked, pointing to the Keurig machine on the counter near the stove. Owen and I both declined. We were anxious enough as it was. The three of us headed over to a small cherrywood table in the corner underneath a small clock, the kind you'd more likely see hanging in an office or waiting room. After we all sat down, Whitmer immediately stood up to remove his blue blazer, hanging it on the back of his chair. He wasn't stalling, but he wasn't exactly rushing either. Finally, after sitting down again, he took a deep breath and began.
I was targeted, he said, his tone straight as a ruler.
To his credit, there wasn't a hint of his trying to make an excuse for himself. He was stating the facts, or really just one fact. They knew my wife was on Flight 93.
Owen and I both dropped our heads a bit.
It spoke volumes about the events of 9/11, that a particular flight number could be so ingrained in the collective memory of a nation.
I'm sorry, said Owen.
Yes, I said. I'm sorry.
The thing is, Whitmer continued,
Grief and anger can help you rationalize almost any behavior in the name of revenge. I know that's what he was banking on with me.
It was so clear what we were witnessing. This was a man who needed to explain himself, bare his soul a little, if not a lot.
I was sure that Owen, even at his relatively young age, was thinking the same thing. Perhaps it was that same youth, though, that had Owen wishing the doctor would explain things just a tad bit faster. Fittingly, the only sound in the kitchen other than us was the measured tick, tick, tick of the wall clock above us.
"He?" Owen asked impatiently. In other words, "Please, for the love of Pete, start naming names."
"I don't know if he's the only ringmaster, but it's certainly his circus," said Whitmer. He drew another deep breath. "Frank Karcher is the one who first approached me." I didn't recognize the name, nor apparently was I supposed to, given the way Whitmer was looking directly at Owen. And given the way Owen was nodding back at him, I guess it made sense. The kid absolutely recognized the name.
"Frank Karcher is the National Clandestine Service Chief of the CIA, said Owen, turning to me. "Basically, we're talking the kind of guy who likes to kick puppies."
"So human torture wasn't much of a leap," I said. It was a quip, completely off the cuff. Still, the second the words left my mouth, I regretted them. I didn't know Karcher, but I did know that Whitmer was sitting right in front of me. He was also on the recordings. At best, the doctor was an accomplice. At worst, that was between him and his God. And that was the point. Owen and I were there in his kitchen to get information, not to pass judgment on him. And I just had. A bit unfairly, no less. I wasn't the one who'd lost his wife on 9/11.
"I apologize," I said to Whitmer.
"I didn't mean to."
"That's all right," he said.
He drew another deep breath. "At the beginning, I knew exactly what I was doing and why. Those recordings you have, as bad as they may look to a whole lot of people, there are just as many people these days, the Machiavellians in our so-called war on terror, who would believe the end justifies the means."
"I'm confused then," I said.
"What changed?
Why would you be talking to us?"
Whitmer leaned in, pressing his palms down on that cherry wood table with what might as well have been the weight of the world. "Because those recordings you have don't tell the whole story," he said. "But mine do."
Chapter 65. Whitmer pushed back his chair and disappeared from the kitchen, returning about a half minute later with an old Dell laptop. While he was gone, Owen and I didn't utter a single word to each other. Really, what was there to say? The doctor had basically just promised to blow our minds. The only thing to do was shut up and wait for it. Another half minute passed while Whitmer's laptop booted up. Given the anticipation, it felt like an eternity. Finally, he clicked on a file and pressed play, angling the screen in front of us so we all had a good view. It was showtime. "This is from the same black site outside of Warsaw during the same time period," he explained. Indeed, from the get-go, everything about the recording looked familiar. The windowless room shot in black and white, the lone metal chair with a Middle Eastern man shackled to it, followed by the two men in suits who restrained him while he received the shot to his carotid artery. Of course, the doctor wielding the syringe looked familiar as well. We were in his kitchen.
"What is your name?" asked the voice off camera. Immediately, a second voice translated the question into Arabic, and as with Owen's recordings, the Arabic was translated back into English via subtitles. Everything was the same. Except in this case, the prisoner's response.
"I speak English," he said softly.
The two voices from behind the camera could be heard conversing, but even with the volume maxed out on Whitmer's laptop, we couldn't understand what they were saying. I assumed it was about the way they wanted to proceed, although you wouldn't know it given how the first voice repeated the question.
"What is your name?"
as if he were some automated prompt.
"My name is Makin Pabalan," answered the prisoner.
Hearing him speak again, it was clear that he was fluent in English. His accent, notwithstanding, there was no hitch from his having to translate in his head from Arabic. If I had to guess, I'd say he'd been educated at some point in the U.S. Again, there was more talking behind the camera. We still couldn't make it out. Whatever was said, though, it resulted in a deviation from the script.
"We'll proceed in English only," came the voice. "Do you understand? The questions will now only be in English."
Yes, said the prisoner. I understand. And you will only answer in English. Is that understood as well?
Yes.
Please state your name again.
My name is Makin Pabalan.
Are you a member of Al-Qaeda?
No,
said the prisoner. Are you aware of any plans by Al-Qaeda to kill American citizens?
No.
Are you a member of any organization that considers the United States of America an enemy?
No.
Are you aware of any organization that is planning to bring harm to any American citizens anywhere in the world?
No.
There wasn't the slightest hesitation from the man in the chair as he answered each question. He looked nervous, but not to the point of fear. Nor was there any anger in his eyes. If I'd been cross-examining him in a courtroom, he would have qualified as a cooperating witness. More importantly, there wasn't the slightest physical change in him. His jaw didn't clench, the chair didn't begin to rattle, there was no downward spiral of pain followed by even more pain, no sign of lie and you die. He was telling the truth. Owen and I exchanged glances, the thought being that the doctor had it wrong. This wasn't the whole story. It was the same story. In unison, we turned to Whitmer. What gives? But he was still staring at the screen, a subtle but unmistakable cue that we should be doing the same. The doctor knew exactly what he was talking about.
Chapter 66. It happens so damn and scary fast. One second the prisoner was fine, the next he wasn't. Only this was different from Owen's recordings. So very, very different. This began in an instant and barely lasted much longer. It was a flash. No, it was a detonation. It was as if the man's brain had actually exploded inside his head. I watched as his eyes rolled back, his face convulsing like it was lodged in a paint mixer at Home Depot. The force was so strong, it literally lifted the man off the ground, chair included. By the time gravity fought back, he and the chair were tipped over on the floor motionless.
Christ, Owen muttered, his voice trailing off.
Whitmer reached out and hit the space bar on the keyboard, pausing the recording. It was right then that the thought occurred to me. As quickly as all hell broke loose in that interrogation room, it wasn't as if the doctor couldn't have tried to intervene. But he was nowhere in the frame. Why not?
That might have been the sickest part of all, Whitmer said, as if reading my mind. The second I tried to help, I was literally held back. They didn't want the guy saved. They wanted him documented. Like a lab rat.
He hit the space bar again to resume the recording. True to his word, Whitmer finally sprang into the frame as if he'd just broken free from the two other guys behind the camera. Within seconds of his kneeling down and placing two fingers on the prisoner's neck, he shook his head slowly. The man was dead.
Was there an autopsy performed? Asked Owen.
Yes, it was an aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, said Whitmer. Each and every time.
Boom.
Wait, what?
I asked. But I'd heard him perfectly.
So had Owen.
It happened 7 other times out of 20 trials, said Whitmer. At least the 20 trials I was overseeing.
Owen shook his head in disbelief.
A 40% fail rate, he said.
Was the prisoner cooperating each time?
The doctor nodded, his gaze retreating. It was as if he had nowhere to look.
Karcher just calls it collateral damage, he said, disgusted. I call it murder.
There was no pushing that last line aside, no ignoring its implications. The word simply hung there at the table, filling the silence. If I hadn't known better, I would have sworn the clock above us had stopped as well. I couldn't hear it tick. Eventually, Owen spoke up.
Does Karcher know you have this recording? He asked.
If he did, I'd probably be dead right now, said Whitmer.
It was hard to argue with that. Owen and I were living proof.
Immediately, all I could picture in my head was this guy, Karcher, arranging for Claire's death, then Owen's, then mine.
Sometimes the only thing more dangerous than a man with nothing to lose is a man with everything to lose. Frank Karcher was every bit that man.
What we need now is the link, said Owen. Proof that the serum exists, that it was used, and that Karcher's fingerprints are all over it.
Am I missing something?
Don't we already have an entire film festival that proves the first two? I asked.
The recordings prove a lot of things, said Owen.
Without the person responsible, though, it's just an embarrassing home movie for the entire country.
Fine, so commence with the congressional hearings, I said.
Owen turned to Whitmer with an air of certitude that people only grant you when you can back it up.
Excuse the assumption, he said, but you didn't actually develop the serum, did you? Nor do you know the name of the person who did, using my research, right?
I was never told, said the doctor. Owen turned back to me, continuing.
And the two henchmen in the recording, the ones restraining the prisoner and ultimately restraining Dr. Whitmer, they're undercover agents. So making the recording, any of the recordings, public, would expose their identities. That's never going to happen.
In other words, I said, what we need is proof that can go public.
Exactly, said Owen.
Without a word, Whitmer pushed back his chair once more and left the kitchen. To quote Yogi Berra, it was deja vu all over again. Owen and I simply looked at each other with nothing to say. Until the doctor returned. He placed what was in his hand on the table.
This might be your answer, he said.
Is that what I think it is? Asked Owen.
Yes, said Whitmer.
He folded his arms.
But let's be very clear about one thing. You didn't get it from me.
Chapter 67. The small white stucco building with only a number next to the door and no other signage wasn't quite hiding in plain sight in the heart of Georgetown. But it wasn't exactly off the beaten path either. From where Owen and I parked, we could look over our shoulders and see the back entrance to a Starbucks out on M Street. That just made this whole thing feel even weirder. Is that even the right word? Bizarre. Surreal. Unnerving? Break out the thesaurus. Behind us were cappuccinos, frappuccinos, and chai mocha lattes with pumps of gooey sweet syrup. In front of us, a top-secret CIA lab producing a lethal truth serum that skirts the U.S. Constitution and the right of due process to the extent that the state of Kansas skirts the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
What are the odds someone's inside? I asked, turning off the engine.
We were an hour past sunset, a lone floodlight overhead providing what little view we had of the one-story building. There were no windows in front.
Owen shrugged his broad shoulders. Whitmer hadn't been able to guarantee the place would be empty.
No clue, he said.
It was the way he said it, though, as if those words were a bit new to him. I couldn't help a slight smile.
That doesn't happen to you a lot, does it?
What's that?
Being clueless about something.
He returned the smile, all modesty aside.
Nope.
I reached into the back seat, grabbing my duffel, which was sitting next to his backpack. The kid had his bag of tricks, I had mine.
What about guns? I asked. Ever fire one?
The look he gave me was the polar opposite of clueless.
I grew up in New Hampshire, he answered.
Enough said. I pulled out the semi-automatic Sig Sauer P210, checked the magazine, and handed it over.
Live free or die.
You ready? I asked. Owen unbuckled his seatbelt, flipped the safety alongside the trigger, and with a blind hand hooked an arm through one of the straps of his backpack.
Ready.
The walk from the car to the building's entrance was no more than 10 yards, albeit a zigzag given all the potholes filled with water from the earlier downpour. I led the way with my Glock, never more thankful for its xenon light and red laser sight. With every measured step I took toward the entrance, that former weapons instructor of mine back at Valley Forge, the one with the sandpaper voice, was all but echoing between my ears. A prick and a prophet all at once.
Sometimes shit happens in the dark.
Chapter 68.
One more for luck, I whispered to Owen, reaching out with my arm.
I was making a fist so tight every fingernail was digging deep into my palm. We'd stationed ourselves on either side of the windowless door, bags at our feet and our backs pressed hard against the stucco. I'd already knocked once. The second knock got the same result. Either the place was empty, or whoever was inside wasn't answering.
My turn, Owen whispered back.
In the age of retinal scanners, digital thumbprint readers, and whatever other paranoid-inspired gizmos exist that make sure only certain people get into certain places, Whitmer had given us a little piece of irony. A simple key.
Actually, it made complete sense. Banks need vaults and guards and security cameras because people know that's where they keep the money. This, on the other hand, was four walls and a roof barely bigger than a shack, tucked behind an alley with all the foot traffic of a vineyard vine store in Newark. In other words, just make sure you lock the door behind you, Doc. Still, Owen and I couldn't help wondering the same thing, hoping, really, that we could trust Whitmer. In a way, he was merely a middleman. The crucial part of his job was picking up the serum and transporting it overseas, an MD as human mule. Possessing all the requisite paperwork for an international humanitarian mission, he was above suspicion. Barely an eyebrow raised through international customs. So much better than swallowing 24 little balloons and a post-flight meal of X-lax. Okay, I whispered to Owen. He was holding up the key, his answer to the question that it would have been redundant of me to ask aloud. What now? Slowly, Owen reached out, slid in the key, and gave it a twist. We braced for everything. An alarm, an attack dog, the night cleaning crew, everything. Instead, pushing the door open, we got exactly what we desperately wanted. Nothing. Just silence and darkness. I motioned for Owen to stay put, peering around the hinges like some guy who'd seen too many cop shows. Before turning on any lights, I wanted to shine my gun around a bit, as it were. The good news about that xenon light attachment was that being on the other side of it was like looking into the high beams of an oncoming car. The flashlight app on Owen's phone times 10. Basically, I was a walking one-way mirror. The first surprise was that there was no reception area, just a short hallway. After a small kitchen to the left and an even smaller bathroom directly opposite on the right, everything was right there in front of me, and it was pretty much as advertised by Whitmer. The facility, he called it. I stared through the blast of white light funneling out from my Glock, the red streak from the laser sight moving with my hands from one corner of the room to the next. Only the far wall had windows, three across with horizontal slat blinds that were drawn and closed tight. What I was looking at was somewhere between a high school chemistry classroom and a meth lab. Not that I'd personally seen a lot of meth labs. Truth be told, everything I knew about them, as well as pedophiles, runaway brides, high school teachers who sleep with their students, and people who try to hire hitmen to kill their spouses, I owe to a guilty pleasure habit of watching Dateline NBC. Even in the moment, the thought was all but inescapable. This would make one hell of an episode. The room was messy, almost chaotic, even in its stillness. There were things everywhere on the large island in the center, vials and beakers, a couple of Bunsen burners, a centrifuge, as well as a few other bulky machines that were a combination of glass and stainless steel, including one that was connected to a large ventilating air duct that shot up straight through the ceiling. There was also a red binder, stuffed thick with papers. What there wasn't, though, was another surprise. We were alone. I looked back over my shoulder, Owen's silhouette peeking out from behind the doorway. "No one home," I said. And technically, that was the truth. Chapter 69. The smartest thing I could do was get out of his way. Owen stepped into the room, flipped on the lights, and closed the door behind him so fast I was out of breath just watching him. The kid was on a mission. At first, I didn't quite understand the rush. Sure, we didn't want to loiter, but it wasn't like there was a shot clock ticking away in the corner. We had time. Then I saw him reach for it. The way he reached for it. Sidling up to the island in the middle of the room, he had over a dozen things to choose from, including what appeared to be the serum itself, contained in a rack of vials. He barely even noticed them, though. It was as if there was only one item he cared about, and that was when I understood. With both hands, he pulled the red binder toward him. Of all the base emotions that must have been kicking around in his head over the past few days, anger, fear, guilt, to name a few, they were still no match for what makes a genius, curiosity. Someone had piggybacked on his brain and taken his work into uncharted territory. It might have been seriously misguided and ultimately doomed, but it was also something else. The one thing in common with anything that pushes the boundaries of innovation.
It was bold. And damn if Owen didn't want to see the blueprint. Silently, I watched him make his way through the pages in the binder, one after another, his index finger tracing the words and formulas like he was in one of those old Evelyn Wood speed-reading commercials. I kept waiting for him to take some sort of mental breather, at the very least a simple pause, scratch his chin, shift his weight from one leg to the other. Instead, he kept plowing his way through, barely even taking the time to blink. Then suddenly, he froze. I took that as my cue, if there was ever going to be one. "What is it?" I asked. Silly me, thinking I was about to get an answer. I was pretty sure Owen didn't even hear me. He was too busy now looking around the rest of the room, his eyes pinballing from one item to the next. Whatever he was searching for, though, he couldn't find it. That was when his head snapped back with an idea. He spun on his heels, disappearing into the small kitchen by the door. I could hear the refrigerator open, followed by the shifting and rattling of metal and glassware. Again, it was like someone had a stopwatch on him. "You okay?" I called out. Owen reappeared, clutching a large styrofoam cup. He was staring down into it. I couldn't see from where I was standing, but I was guessing it wasn't coffee. "Endstoff," he said finally. "Endstoff?" I looked at him blankly. It certainly wasn't my first blank look since we'd been together. "Excuse me?" "That was the code name of chlorine trifluoride at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Nazi Germany." "Great. More Jeopardy. I'll take random trivia when you least expect it for 600, Alex." At my continued blank stare, Owen went on. "The Nazis experimented with chlorine trifluoride as a combined incendiary weapon and poison gas. What a big surprise, right? Thing is, though, it was too volatile. It would literally explode in their faces." "And that's what you're holding in your hand?" I asked. "3 feet away from me?" Owen tilted the cup so I could see the slightly green and yellowish liquid inside it. "It doesn't react with closed-cell extruded polystyrene foam," he said. I shot him a deadpan look.
"You mean styrofoam?"
"Yeah, sorry," he said. "Of course, if this were most any metal, like an aluminum can, for instance, then boom." I swallowed hard. "And thank God for styrofoam," I said.
"But what does chlorinated
chlorine trifluoride," he said. "CTF.
"Yeah, what does CTF have to do with the serum?" I asked.
"I'm not sure it has anything to do with the serum."
"Why are you holding it then?"
It seemed like the obvious question, as did my follow-up. "How did you even know it was here?"
"It's listed in the binder," he said.
"Under what?"
"Inventory."
How neat and organized of them.
"So they needed it for something, right? If not the serum, then what?"
I watched Owen. He was thinking. At least, that was what I thought. His head was cocked to the side, his eyes narrowed to a squint. Of all things, he began removing his sneakers.
"Huh?"
I then watched as he tiptoed past me, oh so quietly in his bare feet, he wasn't wearing socks, and carefully placed the styrofoam cup on the center island in the room before picking up my cig, which he'd set down.
"What's going on?"
I was about to ask that very question, when his index finger shot up in the air, stopping me. Right then I knew. He wasn't thinking. He was listening. He'd heard something. And the next second, I heard it too. Chapter 70. It was the sound of someone trying not to make a sound. An otherwise quiet set of footsteps betrayed by the wet pavement outside the building. My guess was running shoes, maybe cross trainers. Something with a soft and forgiving sole, perfect for sneaking around. Unless, of course, it happened to be after a rainstorm. Rubber and water don't play quietly together. I looked at Owen. He looked at me. We both looked at the light switch by the door. If those footsteps were coming for us, they already knew we were inside. No point making it any easier to be seen. Owen grabbed the binder, stuffing it in his backpack before killing the lights. He settled in the doorway of the kitchen area by the entrance, while I slipped off my pumas and quietly lifted my duffel over to the doorway of the bathroom opposite him. With our shoes off and bags in tow, we looked like we were about to go through airport security. Of course, what we wouldn't have given for an X-ray machine to see through the door outside. No one could blame us for being paranoid, and hopefully that was all we were being. But better to be safe than dead. We had the door covered. Our shoes were back on our feet. I was on one knee with my Glock raised, the xenon light turned off and the laser sight aimed waist high. Next to me, Owen was standing with his strong side legs slightly back like a boxer, and his elbows bent just a little. The Weaver position, as it's commonly called among police and military. Smaller profile, greater stability. Somewhere in his 19 years, someone had clearly taught him that. Not surprisingly, the kid had paid attention. A minute passed with Owen and me having an entire conversation without words, just nods, shrugs, and prolonged stares. Neither of us could hear what we'd first heard. In a glass half-full world, that meant it was just some passerby, a random, maybe some Starbucks employee, excuse me, barista, taking the back way into work. Of course, in the glass half-empty world. We kept listening, our eyes now trained on the door. I could feel the sweat forming in my palms, my right calf cramping, the strain building in my left shoulder from trying to hold my gun steady. It was like 1,000 needle jabs. But all in all, the feeling was relief. The longer we went without hearing anything, the better. Way better. Isn't that right, Owen? I glanced over at him, just a quick snapshot as I'd done before. It was so fast, my eyes were already turning back to the door without really focusing on what I was seeing. After all, I already knew what I was seeing. It was Owen in the same stance he'd had from the get-go. We were maybe 4 feet from each other, give or take an inch or two. Of course, sometimes that's the difference between life and death, isn't it? An inch or two. Chapter 71. My head swiveled back to Owen so fast I could literally feel a breeze in my left ear. He had moved ever so slightly to his right, just enough that his head, barely half of it, really, was now peeking out from the doorway of the kitchen area. Exposed. And just like that, the red dot at the end of the laser sight from my Glock was trained on the back of his skull. Only it wasn't my gun. It was someone else's. "Down!" I yelled, diving across the hallway. The sounds of the shot fired, the broken glass, and my shoulder barreling into Owen's ribcage all rolled into one piercing crack as a second breeze hit my left ear, this one courtesy of the bullet that had just barely missed me, by an inch or two. Owen and I crash-landed on the linoleum floor of the kitchen. Immediately, he had figured it out, the mistake we'd made ignoring the windows. Just because the blinds were closed didn't mean the shooter was blind. Two words. "Thermal imaging," he said. The next sound was the blinds being violently yanked down, followed by more glass breaking. We scrambled to our feet. "He's coming in," I said. "No, but something else is. In 5 seconds, it's going to get real smoky in here." Actually, it was more like 2 seconds. The canister landed with a thud, the sound of it rolling to a stop quickly overtaken by the hissing of the tear gas. I couldn't help stating the obvious. "We've got to get out of here," I said. "Not quite yet," said Owen. Not quite yet? The gas was pushing toward us, filling the hallway. Our eyes and throats were about to get scorched. All I knew was that staying put gave us no chance. The fact that we were armed gave us at least a fighting chance. But Owen didn't even look at the SIG I'd given him, still gripped in his right hand. In fact, he put it down. "What are you doing?" I asked. But he was too busy doing it to answer. He was searching the cabinets above the counter, opening one door after another, until he found it. Owen turned back to me, holding another large styrofoam cup, this one empty. I had no idea what he was thinking. "Please tell me that cup has something to do with our getting out of here," I said. Owen nodded. "It does," he answered. "Now take off your socks." My socks? Chapter 72. There was no time to ask why, not with my eyes feeling the first sting from the tear gas filtering into the kitchen. The first cough couldn't be too far behind. I quickly took off my socks and gave them to him. Hell, if he'd asked me to stand on one leg and clap like a seal, I probably would have done that too. Anything to speed things along. "Now I need some cover," he said.
But Owen didn't pick up his backpack as if we were leaving. And when he stopped just shy of the doorway, waiting for me to line up behind him with my Glock, he wasn't looking left toward the door. He was looking right, as in, right into the line of fire. That was when I knew. He was getting that chlorine stuff, the CTF. Not that either of us could actually see it by this point. He'd left it on the island in the middle of the room, but the cup holding it, along with the island itself, had disappeared in the cloud above the canister. Owen lifted the neck of his t-shirt over his nose for a makeshift mask. Clearly, I'd picked the wrong day to wear a button-down. "Go," I said. I squeezed off a few rounds through the shattered windows as Owen flung himself toward the island. For better or for worse, whoever was out there, singular or plural, knew we were armed. But there was no red stream of light aimed our way, no return fire. Meanwhile, the coughing officially kicked in. Owen was doing the same. On the plus side, it was the only way I could get a read on where he was. I was waiting for his signal so I could spray a few more bullets as he came back. He didn't bother, though. Next thing I knew, he was crawling into the kitchen on his hands and knees. Or at least, one hand. In his other were my two socks. I didn't need to ask what was inside them. Owen had put a cup containing some of the CTF in each one. In fact, I was pretty sure I had it nailed, especially when the first thing he did was grab a lighter from his backpack. What he'd created was akin to a couple of Molotov cocktails straight out of the MacGyver School of Impromptu Weaponry. Light the fuse, aka my dirty socks, and let her rip. Turns out I just got the chemistry backward. I knelt down with Owen, the only breathing room left being a foot off the floor. We were coughing up our lungs now, our throats burning. Tears were streaming down our cheeks. Which made the question he managed to get out all the more bizarre. "You ever play cornhole?" he asked. Once, at a tailgate party before a Yankees game, though I could never bring myself to call it that, it was beanbag toss as far as I was concerned. I nodded. "Yes. Good. Because it's not the fire, it's the water," he said. "Fire's just the accelerator." "What do you mean?" "I mean you've got to hit a puddle, and you've only got one shot." "Cornhole." "Okay," I said. What the hell else could I say? It wasn't exactly the best time to raise my hand and question how water could turn this liquid into a small bomb. Sometimes you've just got to go with the flow. We grabbed our bags. "Maybe there's only one guy out there, but I'm guessing more. We draw their fire and we fire back," he said. "You throw left, I throw right, and then we both run straight as fast as we possibly can." "What about the car?" I asked. Owen looked at me, and of all things cracked a smile. We were at death's door, quite literally, and yet somehow he managed to seem more excited than scared, like a mad scientist about to flip the switch. "Dude," he said, "if this works, there won't be a car." Chapter 73. Here goes everything. I yanked open the door, barely jumping back into the bathroom in time to evade the barrage of bullets littering the hallway. Owen had it pegged. There was definitely more than one shooter. The crisscrossing of all the red laser sights looked more like a Pink Floyd concert, complete with the tear gas as smoke. It was us and them, all right. They had a small army and automatic weapons. We had pistols. Oh yeah, and socks. The split second the first wave ended, I crouched low and peeked outside with the xenon light, squeezing off shots while looking for the nearest potholes filled with water. Not too near, though. Collateral damage is no way to die. I jumped back as the second wave came. This one was even more furious than the first. The drywall was literally disintegrating all around us, every bullet launching a bit of white chalk through the air. Mixed with the tear gas, it was like we were in a snow globe from hell. "Where?" yelled Owen. 15 feet at 10 o'clock, I yelled back. "And yours?" 20 feet at 2. He lit the bottom of his sock and tossed me the lighter. "I'll throw first, then you," he said. "Fine. Age before beauty, dude." I flicked my thumb. The sock caught fire immediately. I'd say the feeling was like holding a live grenade, but it wasn't like that. It was that. Spinning around again,
I sprayed bullets back and forth like a windshield wiper before stepping aside so Owen could throw. I was giving him light from my Glock the best I could. As soon as he released his sock, he unloaded the rest of his magazine and peeled to the side. My turn. There was no time to aim, but there was also no time to think about it and choke. I just let it fly. It was the second little fireball tossed through the air. Who knows what they must have thought? Maybe nothing at all. They were too busy trying to gun us down as we dove back out of the doorway. I tossed another magazine to Owen, who quickly reloaded. There was one thing he'd forgotten to mention. When this CTF stuff mixes with water, how long does it take before, boom? The explosion shook and shattered everything around us. Every wall, every nearby window. Suffice it to say, anyone standing outside was no longer on their feet. The proverbial rug not just yanked out from beneath them, but incinerated. But how long until one of them got back up? Good question. Run, right now! Owen and I did our best Butch and Sundance, launching out of the building with guns blaring. We were sprinting as fast as we could, hoping against hope that we'd bought ourselves enough time. That made for an even better question. Was that boom the result of one sock or two? That was when I saw him. Looking over my shoulder, it was one of the shooters, a clone of the two guys up in New York. Was there a factory somewhere? Dazed but clearly determined, he was staggering to his feet with his arm raised, and it wasn't to wave hello. Thank God, it was only one sock. Boom! Owen and I caught the edge of the second blast. It seared our backs and sent us hurtling forward across the pavement for the evil Knievel of road rashes. It hurt like a son of a bitch, like I was being skinned alive. And I'd never felt luckier in my life. As we helped each other up, we looked back to see we were the only ones still standing. Not that we were about to linger.
I'd high-five you, but I have no skin left on my palms, said Owen.
Me neither, I said. Come on, I know a doctor we should see.
Chapter 74. There's angry, then there's smoldering, and then there's literally smoldering.
What's that smell? Asked the cab driver. It's like something's burning.
It's just our clothes, I said matter-of-factly. The smell was also our singed flesh, but I didn't feel the need to mention that. Either way, that little tree-shaped air freshener hanging from the guy's rearview mirror didn't stand a chance. We'd been burned, all right. Set up big time. And now it was time for a little follow-up visit with Dr. Douglas Whitmer. No appointment necessary. He was so convincing in his kitchen. Of course he was. He was telling us the truth. The only lie was his allegiance. Who the hell did he call after we left him? We had the taxi drop us off one block down from his townhouse. There was no telling if Whitmer was still alone, but first we had to see if he was there at all. Maybe he'd gone to church for confession. If he had, he'd walked. His black Jaguar was still there, parked in the driveway as when we'd first approached him. Too bad he hadn't given us a second key, the one to his front door. How soon before a neighbor calls 911? I whispered to Owen, only half-joking as I peered inside one of the windows. With our tattered, blood-stained clothes and shredded hands, knees, and elbows, the two of us looked like we'd just wandered off the set of The Walking Dead. At best, we were a couple of burglars. At worst, it was the zombie apocalypse. I turned back to Owen when he didn't respond. He'd been right behind me. Now he wasn't anywhere. Finally, I found him back down by the street. He was staring up at a telephone pole.
What are you doing? I asked. Looking for the camera.
What camera?
They were watching from either inside or outside. Actually, probably both, he said. Inside, though, gave them audio.
I stood there trying to reverse engineer what he was saying. If we were being watched when we first showed up to see Whitmer, then that meant...
Jesus, why didn't you say anything? I asked. We were coming here to confront him. He ratted us out.
I never said that.
You didn't have to. It was a given, I said.
At least I thought it was.
You mean, he didn't tip them off?
Highly unlikely.
Then why are we even here?
Owen was still staring up at the pole. To search for more evidence, he said. Stuff he didn't share with us.
What, you think he's going to let us just waltz right in and take what we want?
Finally, Owen turned to me. We're hardly going to need his permission, he said. Before I could ask why not, he was already halfway back to Whitmer's townhouse, heading up the steps. Once again, the best I could do was try to keep up with him.
Chapter 75. There was zero hesitation, none whatsoever. In fact, Owen had already taken off his t-shirt, what was left of it, and wrapped it around his hand by the time he reached the top step. I was only a few feet behind him, but I could see what was coming next a mile away. What's a little breaking and entering among friends? With a quick right jab, the window to the left of Whitmer's front door all but disappeared. Working clockwise, Owen knocked away the few holdout shards until we could both climb through without donating any more blood for the evening. Just a guess, but being 2 pints down on a cavernously empty stomach is probably not recommended by the American Medical Association. Owen put his t-shirt back on, entering first. I followed. And at no time did I bother asking him what he wasn't telling me. I figured I'd know soon enough. Even sooner, as it turned out, when our arrival in Whitmer's foyer was greeted with nothing and no one. Just a dead silence. The proverbial bad feeling about this was suddenly spreading fast from my gut. Upstairs, said Owen. He might have just been talking to himself. I couldn't tell. Either way, there was no sign of the doctor on the first floor. If sparsely furnished was the polite way of describing the downstairs of Whitmer's home, the upstairs made the first floor look like an episode of Hoarders. Of the first 3 bedrooms we looked into, only one actually had a bed. And by bed, I mean a queen-size mattress on top of a box spring on top of a Harvard frame. No sheets, no pillows, and still no Whitmer. Which only made it worse, that feeling of dread, the tightening of the chest muscles, the extra pull on the lungs with each breath, the inescapable truth of something inevitable. Because at no time, not for one fraction of a second, did I think there was a chance that Whitmer wasn't there in his home. The only question was where.
Here, said Owen.
This time he was definitely talking to me, pointing to. He'd turned the corner into the master bedroom. 2 steps past the doorway, I saw him. Whitmer, wearing the same clothes as when we'd left him, was lying in the bed on his back. If I hadn't known better, I'd have said he was simply asleep. But I did know better, if only because Owen knew better. Whitmer was never waking up.
Chapter 76. Means and motivation. The whole story was right there in front of us, exactly as intended. Although it wasn't intended for us. On the bed next to Whitmer, where the ghost of his wife surely slept, was a large photo album open to a spread filled with happy, loving pictures of the two of them in Paris. They were kissing in front of the Eiffel Tower, arm in arm beneath the external habit trail-like piping of the Centre Pompidou in Beaubourg, and playfully leaning against Louis Debray's Le Prophète in the Jardin du Luxembourg, the golden head of the statue and their faces beaming in the sunshine. Claire and I used to talk about going to Paris together. But life is 90% talk, isn't it? As if connecting the dots, my eyes moved from the photo album over to the empty pill bottle, the orange-brownish variety you get from your local pharmacy. Only there was no label on it, no indication of a prescription. Ironically, that made the story even more convincing. Whitmer was a doctor, after all. What pills wouldn't he have access to? It all made so much sense. Of course, that was why it was all bullshit. I was catching on quick, all right. Certainly faster than the police would, if at all. Odds were they never would. This was no suicide.
Temazepam, if I had to guess, said Owen with a nod to the empty pill bottle. Very effective for insomnia. Michael Jackson notwithstanding. 1 injection, probably to the carotid artery, and the coroner would never know the drug wasn't swallowed. The image of Whitmer giving injections to the prisoners in Stare Kikuti flashed through my mind. Oh, the irony. Without even thinking, I leaned in, looking at Whitmer's neck for a needle mark. I didn't know why, I just did.
I felt sorry for him. He'd made his choices. But he didn't deserve this.
Christ, we can't even call the police, I said.
Whitmer lived alone. There was no telling how long it would be before his body was discovered. The same could be said for the guy in my bathtub back in Manhattan, but I couldn't give a rat's ass about